This is David Hausman, and I'm here in Parliament in Honiara, Solomon Islands, with Sir Peter Kenilorea, the first Prime Minister of Solomon Islands and current Speaker of Parliament.
All right.
Sir Kenilorea, have you consented to be recorded for this interview?
Yeah, I have.
Great. So let me start by asking you a bit about your background in the public service and how you came to be speaker today.
Yeah, well, thank you very much indeed. In terms of public service, as a public servant, I spent 12 years in Solomon Islands, 9 years in the public service before going into active politics for a further 16 years. After which I became a regional civil servant when I became a director of a regional organization that deals with fisheries in the South Pacific called the Forum Fisheries Agency. Sorry. After my term, which was 3 years with the Forum Fisheries Agency, I was then appointed the Ombudsman of Solomon Islands for 5 years between 1996 and 2001. And since 2001, I've been the Speaker of Parliament. The term of the Speaker of Parliament is 4-year term, and I'm now on my second term, towards the end of my second term now. We are having general election next year, 2010, and following that, there's normally the election of the Speaker. I might be kicked out, I might continue. I don't really know what the future holds at the moment.
Okay, thanks so much. Let me ask you a bit now about the goals and motivation for the current program of public service improvement or strengthening or reform here. Could you talk about the issues and challenges facing the public service when the current program of strengthening started, so I guess after the tensions?
Yeah. Well, after the tension, the public service collapsed during the tension, and therefore all institution of governance, although they were there in the books, they were not really practiced as they should have been, and so following the tension, we have this regional assistance mission to Solomon Islands, whose objective was to not only revive the economy and bring in law and order, but also help with strengthening of the governance institutions. So they put in various activities and program to strengthen the public service. There has been some very specific program to strengthen the accountability departments, like the Auditor General's Office, the Ombudsman's Office, the Leadership Code Commission Office, and of course there's one for Parliament Office, the Parliament Strengthening Program. There's been some specific direct programs involved by Ramsey following the tension to help strengthen the public service generally.
I wonder if you could say a little more about how exactly the public service fell apart during the tensions.
Well, I suppose it just non-performance by public officers because the militants, I suppose we could say they were in power then. You know, they held the guns and Public officers were simply frightened of the situations, and it amounted to either working under duress or just non-performance because of fear generally and non-attendance at proper times because of the situation then. I think one of the major weakness in the public service, in my own observation, is one of attitude. Attitude of the human component of the public service. In terms of institutions of governance, there's no lacking in that. Various guidelines and institutions are in place. But the human component of the public service attitude has much to be desired in terms of work ethic, in terms of having a pride in what you do, in terms of attendance, and therefore result in affecting work performance and end product. So that I think, to be fair on the tension, existed before the tension, and even the tension has now gone. I think the one of the human component of the public service, one of attitude, I think continues to be a challenge to us. Solomon Islands, you know, typical island laid-back attitude. You know, tomorrow is another day kind of attitude. And so I don't know whether there are schools for attitude or how the system can change attitude, because it's a very important area to consider. Maybe motivation through certain things, I don't know, reward, good condition of service. But attitude is the main enemy to our public service at the moment.
I wonder if you could tell me a little bit more about the genesis of the current improvement efforts.
Yeah.
How they first started after Ramsey arrived.
Yeah. Well, the improvement certainly started after Ramsey arrived, in the sense that in Ramsey program there is the civil aspect of not all military, the civil aspect of that particular program helped in actually working the public service, working along with the public service staff as advisors. Some of them were on line post actually doing the work, and hence the public service, I suppose, in their performance was revived through that means. And we continue to have the advice of Ramsey personnel in these various capacities. My own personal observation and concern simply is that you can have the best advice in the world provided and available to you. But unless you make use of that advice and, you know, take it and run with it yourself, you know, advice is only as good as you accept it and do it and use it. So that will continue to be my own personal concern.
So how was it, I guess, step by step, that the first Ramsey Machinery of Government programs got underway, so the accountability institutions and the parliament program?
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose they came and have a look at what the current situation is, and then decided to develop these various aspect of improving them, strengthening them. For example, in the Parliament Strengthening Program, we had a, what they call legislative need assessment, and we found out that our Parliament was very much lacking in facilities, in manpower, in professional, you know, personalities. And so under the financing or funding of UNDP and the Australian the government through RAMSI, this particular program was instigated. We had a project manager of the program who we got from New South Wales Parliament.
Was that Warren Cahill?
Warren Cahill. And we were very lucky to have this particular person because he had such an experience in the kind of work that Parliament does. And he was not only a manager, he was also a mentor. His personality, you know, went down well with Solomon Islanders' liking. And so he was able to encourage the young graduates. And one of the main success, one of the main reasons for the success of the program, in my view, was that we recruited a new graduate direct after their qualification from university. They've not gone through the public service. So we got them straight from the university, and Warren was able to work with them and then show them the important ropes, what to do. And he worked very closely with them as he himself worked too. He was not only working to them, but he was working with them. Now he's left us after 4 years or so. But the system still is working very well to my liking at the moment. Hopefully we'll keep the young graduates we've trained so far, and that they will not run away from us to greener pastures elsewhere. Although they've got their own freedom, and some of them have already gone elsewhere.
I'm going to ask you a lot more about that program, yeah. But before I do, let me ask you a bit more generally about about the initiatives started by Solomon Islands government and RAMSI. I suppose in 2005 or so, with the accountability institutions as well as the parliamentary program, was there a process of consultation between RAMSI personnel and Solomon Islands government personnel? Were there consultations that you were involved in?
No, I was not involved in any other consultation with any other accountability institution except the Parliament one. Yeah, the Parliament one, I was very close with it because I was involved even during the assessment needs part of it. When we were approached as to what our priorities might be for assistance through RAMSI, I said we need to be strengthened. And if there is a program for that, we will appreciate it very much. And so this particular program came about.
And what would you describe as the motivation for these reforms? Was it driven by Solomon Islands government, by public demand, by RAMSI?
Yeah, I think by both, I would say. The government sets the policy guidelines, and Ramsi actually make use of their professionalism and expertise to actually produce the programs and the results. So much so that sometimes politicians were complaining that Ramsi was running the country, or there was a parallel kind of government running the country. I was concerned that there was some perceptions along that line, but I knew that they were here to do some work, and if there is unclear policy by the government, they had to do something anyway, and they went ahead and do it the way they knew, and it must have been perceived by some as Ramsi running the country.
And I've been told that there was a process of consultations and planning for what is now the Public Service Improvement Program.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Were you involved in that process?
When the MOG team came, I suppose I can say that I was involved in that, in the sense that they asked questions like you're doing with me now about the public service, but outside of that kind of visit and giving you ideas on you know, how and where to go and what do you think we should do, and you know, beyond that I was not very much involved. But there were consultative arrangements, you know, followed by Ramsi personnel. They went around from ministry to ministry, the department seeking views of various ones. The teams consisted of members of Ramsi and the Solomon Islander counterparts.
Can you say a bit more about how they consulted you?
Well, they simply made appointments to see the speaker, and whether or not the speaker has something to say about what they're about in the public service, you know, their ideas about public service revival of various institutions. That is a kind of consultation I was involved in, nothing else.
And in terms of the other consultations that you described, how extensive were they, and do you think they've had major effects?
Yeah, I think that, you know, they went out of their way, in my view, to actually give opportunities for people who'd like to make an input into their consultation process to be involved. I know that much. I do not know whether the consultation was intended to get outside of Honiara, you know, to the provinces and that sort of thing. But there must have been provincial consultation too, because there's also now a program of provincial strengthening program. So I'm sure relevant consultations, maybe through the ministry, provincial government, must have been adequately done.
And do you think the consultations had much of a role in building goodwill for the
measures? Yeah, yeah. I think we, in Solomon Islands, a lifestyle, we believe in consultation. A lot of time-consuming consultation in our traditional kind of lifestyle. So we appreciated that that kind of approach that was employed by the professionals when they came to try to assess what program was needed in order to bring about the strengthening of the public service in general.
And I guess out of curiosity, what sorts of consultation is there traditionally in Solomon Islands?
It's just a lot of time consuming, sit around and talk about certain issues until it is understood, it is believed to be understood by everybody, and it always end up in consensus agreement or approval.
And do you think the consultations affected the outcome or the actual planning for the program?
Yeah, I think not necessarily the outcome, but I think it helps towards the planning of the program. The outcome really depends on the human element that work the plans to achieve. Yeah.
And you know of any specific ways in which the planning was affected by these consultations?
I think simply because they visited various ones to get information before they get down to their planning for purposes of these various programs. So I think the consultation must have contributed towards whatever the plans eventually came up with.
And what relation have the government and politicians had with the reform process? I know it's happened under three governments.
I suppose in terms of the politicians, as I was saying, their responsibility was firstly setting the policy guidelines, that they approve these various basic development to improve the public service. And I suppose that's the executive government. But the parliament mainly continues to have their involvement in their general oversight activities, whether this program through reports that comes to parliament, they're having any effect, or whether or not there's been some progress in some areas of the public service because of these various developments. So members of parliament have the benefit of these reports coming to them to parliament, and therefore have the chance of scrutinizing them and therefore involved in the oversight role. And the executive government, I'm sure, were involved simply in the policy guidelines, working closely with the Ramsey people came.
And have there been major changes in the level of political support for the programs? Changes in government?
I suppose there's not been obvious change in the level of support one way or the other. It's just been understood that these plans are in place to help strengthen the public service. I think that's the attitude that the government has taken.
And I guess that the reforms have followed a sort of incremental process of a few reforms at the beginning and now a broader plan.
Yeah.
How do you think that has worked out as a strategy?
Yeah, I think it worked out well in the sense that, as you said initially, there was some the activities were along visiting various ministry and department and trying to work to strengthen these various areas, almost concentrating on areas that they found were weak. Recently, they've developed an overall plan which the government refers to as a framework of partnership, which brings together the guidelines for activities for, there's no end to it anyway, so one would not talk in terms of towards some exit time period. There's no nothing to that effect in the partnership framework. I suppose they leave that silent for a while. But in my view, the partnership framework cooperation is now able to bring together ideas of the mission and the government to continue serving the country.
And do you think that broader framework came at about the right time, or too early, or too late?
I think it may be too late, in my view. Yeah, I think it might be too late, but then I suppose when we consider it as they came and simply want to pick up the pieces first of all, and then have time to think about how to rationalize development after the pieces have been picked up, I suppose in that sense it came at the proper time as well, but one would have thought, and I suppose it's been difficult too, because Ramsey has been operating through three governments now, I think. Or is it four? Yeah, three.
I think it's three.
Yeah. So, I think it's a right time, because the immediate needs have been attended to, and now the present government sees it fit to actually consolidate and have some kind of framework to see how to go from here. So I suppose in that sense it's good timing. Whereas the two previous governments were simply picking up the pieces. They were busy in the different divisions just to ensure that things operate.
Do you know whether in the planning for these measures some options were discarded, and if so, what they were and why?
No, I'm not privy to that kind of activity. Yeah, I suppose. I'm sure the Minister of Public Service will be very useful there.
Okay, well, let me ask you a bit more specifically about the parliamentary strengthening program that you've been involved in, and I guess about the genesis of that. How did it first start?
Yeah, well, as I said earlier, there was a general regional assessment of parliamentary work in the region under the UNDP. All the countries, all the island countries in the region have been visited by this particular group and looked at parliaments in the region. And in our case, I think it happened in 2002. We had our parliament assessment needs in 2002. And we were found wanting in terms of staff, in terms of facility, in terms of institutional procedures and that sort of thing. So when we were approached whether or not we have anything to concentrate on after detention, and when Ramsey came, they were looking for strengthening the public service, as we were talking about earlier on, we suggested that they should pick up this particular area of looking at strengthening the parliament capacity and ability to perform its work of oversight and representation properly.
Was there someone in particular you suggested it to? How did that suggestion first surface?
The suggestion service through that normal consultation of the the machinery of government group. They had a visit here, and I raised it with them that I would appreciate a program or a project that would help improve performance of Parliament. Of course, the report of the legislative need assessment was available at the time, so Solomon Island Parliament needs was quite clear, and we raised it with them, and hence that particular project came in 2004, I think it was.
And how did you decide on the plan for the program?
We had meetings between the likely stakeholders, like UNDP, who was quite open to help in the particular program, the Australian AUSAID through Ramsey representative. So we had meetings of the likely stakeholders and come up with suggested overall ideas as to what this might mean. And we set up committees to oversee the project or the program. And then we recruited a project manager who actually put things together and ran with it for us.
And what were some of the options that you considered when you were in the planning stage?
In what sense?
For how to structure the program. For example, whether to recruit new graduates or
yeah, yeah, yeah. We started with that idea, because the new public service has collapsed, and there was a training element in the program that was going to be financed by the financiers or funders of the program. So I suggested that we should have direct entrance into the program from universities. I suppose you're very innocent and pure from university, I hope, and be directly employed by this program. In terms of the number of them, of course, the project manager helped us out with having assessed the needs of Parliament office and parliamentarians. So we started off with 5, I think, and it has increased now to 7. Yeah. It was the training, during the training period, or during the program that we have now with us, a lot of funding for the training and recruitment of the new recruits came under the program. In the meantime, we've also developed the establishment that is necessary for sustaining this this work after the training phase is over. We came up with establishment and then went back to the public service to said, okay, we need to have this sustainable. We need to continue with this after Ramsey goes away. We have trained this personnel up to this particular level. We need them to continue to do the work. Would you put them on our establishment, Parliament establishment? And that's how we gradually taking them on our payroll. Then it's so far it's been working. The public service has not turned us down as yet.
And can you describe how the program got going step by step?
Yeah, I suppose it's just the good work of the project manager. I had great faith in this project manager, and the everyday activity of the program, of the training with the new recruits, I was not involved in. That was left for the manager and the clerk to do. And when it comes to any either change of policy part of it, they ask my view and my endorsement, and we go from here. In the meantime, we have a continuing committee that oversight this particular project that meet regularly, not very often, but regularly.
Who was on that committee?
Representative of various stakeholders, as I said. UNDP is represented, USAID is represented, Ramsey is represented, Solomon Island government is represented, and I chair it. Because I'm supposed to be the director of the program. That does very little. I trust my staff, and I was very pleased to pick the right project manager. They ran with the nitty-gritty of it.
And what was the substance of the training?
Well, we've now trained committee secretaries. We have five parliamentary committees. Before the program, it's only the clerk that is secretary for all five committees. Now, all the separate five committees have different secretariat, which is run by these trained new graduates. We had an IT personnel or officer who was responsible for training of our staff here with computer usage, because now this office is computerized. He set up a computer cafe for the members of parliament in the members' lounge. If they're interested in computer. Some of us found that old dogs don't learn new tricks, and we leave it at that. They've established the website for Parliament. We have a public awareness officer, education officer, or division.
Are these all former trainees?
Yeah.
And how long did the training program last? What was the structure of the curriculum for graduates?
It's an ongoing one throughout the phase one of the project, and now we're in phase two. The training is continues throughout those phases of the program. The end result in terms of producing these officers have been done, but they continue to work together as a team under the project manager for the period of the program. As I said, we're now in our second phase. It will go on until 2011 or 12, I think, yeah.
And how did the training work in practice? Was it more classroom training or more on-the-job training?
On-the-job training. That is on-the-job training, actual mentoring. That's why I said that the gentleman we picked from Australia was very good at that. They all worked together in the library. If he needs them to have some time of actual training, they do that themselves. But the information technology officer goes around the different department and help them in their IT needs.
And is that a trainee from the program?
Yeah. Now we've got two IT officers now on our payroll, which means that the public service have accepted these posts to be permanent posts of Parliament. We have got legal officers who, again, have grown up and help us with legal matter, procedural matter, constitutional matters. Now I do not necessarily have to go to Attorney General all the time, or the Attorney General's office all the time. I can seek immediate legal advice from my own officers here. I hope to develop them into a stage where we can have our own parliamentary tradesperson or tradesman.
And how did these officers learn the substance of, for example, IT and law?
Yeah, well, that's their qualification at the university before we take them in. And apart from their practical training here, they go out on short courses to Australia, New Zealand. To help them, I suppose, with their confidence. And the kind of short training outside applies to all of our training. They go out. We've got, I think, two now in New Zealand going for their masters. I hope we'll get them back here. I hope we'll get them back here and we'll not lose them to the general public service out there.
You mentioned before that Warren Cahill was particularly effective at working together with the graduates. What were some of the characteristics that made him effective, do you think?
I think he was a very experienced person. He was very knowledgeable of the subject matter. He just had a kind of personality that goes down well in terms of teamwork with Solomon Islanders. He has got the ability of throwing you in deep end and then picking you up again when you need to be. That sort of thing. So he creates confidence that way. You do it, and if you can't, I'll soon find out,
Are there any particular examples or anecdotes that you remember?
No, I think maybe the boys who work with him will have better knowledge of that. But I think he was a good listener, and he was just good with human elements to really get them interested, excited, and maintain the interest. I think the important part was he really knew what he was doing. So the young graduates respect him for that.
Yeah. And then, while we're on the subject, let me ask you more broadly. Are there things about the context and culture here that you think affect the way public service strengthening should be done?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that's what I was saying, that one of the cultural aspect of Solomon Islanders is tomorrow is another day. The kind of laid-back attitude. And then when it comes to discipline, it's very difficult to discipline your, we call it here, one talk. Because I suppose basically our lifestyle is living for each other. We live in a communal kind of lifestyle traditionally. So we don't want to, as it were, report on others. And when it gets into public service, it spoils it. Discipline becomes weak because you don't want to tell off some of your so-called one talks. Solomon Islanders are your one talks, everyone. So some of those cultural influences, which if not properly recognized and controlled, would interfere with efficiency and effectiveness of public service performance.
Have you seen any good examples of these things being recognized and either integrated or controlled in the public service?
I think they've been recognized in our various general orders, rules, and regulations, and that sort of thing. But then implementing, enforcing them, is yet another story. I think that's an aspect that will be with us for a long time. We'll have to grow out of it, maybe through education, so that in work you exercise some impersonality. When you exercise discipline, you don't become too personally attached to certain actions which might interfere with the right thing to do.
And are there examples you remember from your own experience in the public service
of yeah.
how these factors practically affect the
service? My own personal my own personal leadership principle is by example. And if I can't talk because of cultural situation, I simply do it. So that when people know that, when my subordinate knows that the boss is working, we should be working too. You know, that kind of attitude. Yeah, throughout my service, throughout my working life, to avoid any difficulties with this traditional kind and cultural influence, I simply believe in leadership by example. You do what you say. You know, you tell people what you do. Don't expect him to do what you say. And again, that has got a lot of respect in our society. You know, you say a lot, but you don't do anything. They said, oh, it's all hot air, signifying nothing. He needs to support what he says by his doing.
And to what extent do you think donors have been able to adapt to this environment and work?
I think I'm sure they're struggling to understand because I think they're understanding, but to accept it may be another struggle because you know, the culture of the public service should be an international culture. It should cross all boundaries. It should be a culture of its own that is serving the public, you know, action-oriented, target-achieving, all that kind of thing. It should not be influenced by culture. For those of us who have got our culture, I was sharing with you, need to simply grow up and be able to understand that you know, public service should have its own culture, or not only should, has its own culture, and we need to respect that.
Let me go on and ask you now about the various accountability institutions and their respective roles in accountability in the public service.
Right, yeah.
So I guess that's the Office of the Auditor General, the Leadership Code Commission,
yeah.
and the Ombudsman.
Ombudsman. Yeah.
And then also, though this is in a slightly different domain, the Public Service Commission. Could you describe the division of responsibilities among these institutions?
Yeah, the Auditor General, obviously, it's obvious. Their work, they ensure that government money is spent on, you know, according to budget and according to, you know, financial procedures and regulations. The Ombudsman and the Leadership Code Commission, in my view, work very closely on issues that are very close to each other. One deals with the leadership Another one deals with maladministration. But they're dealing with the same people, public officers. And the main weakness in all three of them before Ramsey came was one of capacity. You know, I was an ombudsman for 5 years, and whilst we were expected to serve the entire country, we had only, when I came in the office, I had only one investigator, and he was also doing administrative work as well. I was successful to have another one, so by the time I left in 2001, the office had only two investigating officers. And because of that, the ombudsman has to do investigation himself too. Yeah, apart from making reports and that sort of thing. So it's a capacity. Capacity, the human capacity, and the capacity of necessary equipment and finances. During my 5 years, we've never visited the province because lack of financial resources to do that. We work only from Honiara. Although we were dealing with about 400 cases per year from Honiara itself. Of course, province is right in terms of complaints and that sort of thing, but we have not visited them, which was very bad. You know, we so in my view, it's a capacity of these accountability institutions that was very poor at that time, pre-tension, during and immediately after. Now, I'm very happy with the Ramsey's effort to bring these institutions up to what is expected of them. I think before Ramsey arrived, the Auditor General's Office, for example, only had about 3 staff. They now have about 20-something, I think. Which is an example of capacity building in terms of the institution. It was quite obvious. They're doing the same now with the Leadership Code Commission. And apart from the improvement of the capacity of the human beings and facilities, they're also looking at the laws that govern these various institutions. I know that they're working at possible amendments of the various legal provisions that govern these institutions to help them more effective and more productive, I suppose. But it's not so much part of the law, it's enforcement of this law that we need to look at. And that is where resources are very important. When I went to the Ombudsman's office, I took over. My predecessor have never produced one report or any report to Parliament, although the Constitution mandates the Ombudsman to produce an annual report to Parliament. Not one in 5 years. And his handover note to me was that was due to lack of resources.
So I've heard a lot about the success of the strengthening of the Office of the Auditor General. But what about the other two accountability offices?
I know that they're working on the human element of it, in other words, recruitment. So the Leadership Code Commission and the Ombudsman are in the same boat that way, that they are beefing their staffing up. And as I said, they're looking at their laws to help them, I suppose, be relevant and strengthened and effective. I don't know whatever else, what other areas in those two commissions they've been looking at. I know that the Ombudsman have a lot more staff now. Yeah. But in terms of facilities, they're just building offices for them. I think that those two institutions are going to be properly housed soon, so that might be an impetus for a better performance and improved output.
Let me ask you another slightly more general question. In the aftermath of the tensions, were there issues with tensions in the workplace, I guess ethnic, geographical, religious tensions? And if so, how did you deal with them?
After?
Yeah, or before, or during.
Oh yeah, during and the difficulties we had was during the tension, not after, because when we had Ramsey in, law and order was immediately arrested and dealt with, and therefore the only difficulty lies with resources to help public officers to perform their work. And the beginning of all this development of strengthening programs and projects. But during the tension, it was very difficult. It was very difficult because, you know, you go to office with guns around and all that sort of thing, and it's totally new experience to us. And we lost the police altogether. The element of police that was left was also infiltrated by militants. And so for some reason, the police that was left over also joined in with some militants to call themselves joint operations. So it was quite difficult to, especially to go into finance office and you see them all there. Really, if Ramsey did not come when it did, I don't know where Solomon Islands would be now.
And after Ramsey arrived, was there any lingering resentment in the workplace?
Oh yeah,
among different groups, and if so, and how did you manage it?
No, not among the working people, amongst the working people and the militant elements. Because especially in finance, because they were also trying to get their hands on finances and that sort of thing. Yeah. And of course, a lot of militants were employed as special constables under the pretext of looking after Honiara. So, in terms of payment, they insisted they be paid first before everyone else. And so, it was quite difficult to work, but as soon as law and order came through Ramsey, things went back to more normal in terms of law and order. Although it will continue to be a challenge to law enforcement institutions, but it is not as bad as the tension period. Afterward, no, it's okay. Before that, there's not very much interference with the work. But it's during the tension that was, as I said, it was a new experience, and it was very unfamiliar to some of us, especially those of us who are trying to be in the mainstream of peace making and that sort of thing. I was the chairman of the peace process during the tension, and as I said, it was a totally new experience. But because the government simply appointed me, a job I didn't apply for, then I just have to do it. I enjoy it. It's nice to get back to normal situation. Yeah.
Let me ask you a little bit about some employment procedures, which you may want to answer either from the perspective of the whole public service or from a particular program you're involved in recently. Can you describe the procedures and standards used in recruitment?
Recruitment. Yeah. Recruitment is done by the public service. And the Public Service Commission finally approved the applicants. So the recruitment is done by the public service in terms of processing advertisements, job descriptions or job specifications, all these sort of things. They put up notices for recruitment. One applies for the job, and then there is the interview. And after the interview, you are successful or not successful. So it involves advertisement, recruitment, and appointment.
And how did the recruitment work in the parliamentary strengthening program?
Oh, the recruitment, we do it the same way it applies anyway, I suppose, because you look at the CVs of various ones who apply. Advertisement, we put up an advertisement and people apply. And there is an interview, the clerk is involved, the project manager is involved. I've never been involved. I leave them do that sort of work. And then there's the best judgment, or depending on the curriculum vitae or these new recruits, I suppose.
Yeah. And can you describe the procedure for promotions and how it works in practice?
I've been out of public service for a long time now, but during my time, promotions are based on examinations. Of course, I do not see examinations now. I suppose now promotion is dependent on performance and experience. In other words, time spent on job. Everyone is entitled to annual increment, of course. There's an annual increment provision in the system. But for promotions, it's dependent obviously on reports by your superiors, and there should also be an annual report or by the personnel manager of the various departments or the ministries. And any proposed promotion is made by the ministry and submitted to the commission, the Public Service Commission. It is the Public Service Commission that decides on promotions. This Public Service Commission is responsible for appointment, promotion, and discipline.
And I've heard from others that there are often significant delays while waiting for the Ministry of Public Service to approve recruitment and promotion choices. Have you experienced that as well?
That experience is very common. Some of the cases end up with the Ombudsman's Office. You know, I've been here for donkey's years and I've never been promoted. Why? So if they can't get the sense out of their ministries, they go to the Ombudsman's to help them clarify their own situation. Sometimes it's either they forgot or it's a defective system or lack of performance, but sometimes you can be on probation for a long time than necessary. Otherwise the time period for promotion is 2 years.
Could you describe how in cases like these the Ombudsman might work together with the Public Service Commission?
They receive it as a complaint, as a formal complaint. And so they follow it up with the public service office as a complaint by this particular officer. And of course, all they can receive is explanation as to why. Sometimes they acknowledge the fact that, it's just an oversight. Yeah, the officer has been in that particular post and we just forgot him or something. If it needs confirmation, they simply recommend confirmation of the office of public service, that is, and they simply recommend confirmation to the commission to confirm the officer. If it needs promotion, then the public service passes the case to the commission. I find out that if these procedures work well as I expected and are provided for under various document or administrations of the public service, the Ombudsman would have very little work to do, because it's merely complaints about maladministration. And, because during my time, there was an average of, say, about 34% of complaints that are found to be true, that they've got a case. Most of it is a way, maybe it's just a non-issue. It's misdirected complaints would go to the police or to the labor or to the union instead of the ombudsman, or even to the court system. Yeah, but I found out that about 35% or 34% of the complaints received were positive ones.
I've also been told that there are significant problems with absenteeism in some parts of
That's
the public
right.
service.
Yeah.
Have you encountered this problem, and have you seen some effective solutions to it?
Yeah, that's why I like getting the new recruits from the university direct to my office here, because we train them work ethic. We train them with the idea that, you know, you've got a work to do. But in the public service generally, that kind of complaint is real. There's been so lax in terms of time attendance and leaving work before time and all that sort of thing. Then again, it shows that lack of discipline. Discipline needs to be strengthened.
All right, let me ask you just a couple more questions before we stop. Do you think there are things about the context here that make some of the lessons learned here inapplicable elsewhere? Or do you think that most of the lessons learned here could work in other countries as well?
A public service was to have its own culture. It should apply anywhere, everywhere. But of course, some of its weaknesses here is certainly it's just in context in terms of our own cultural situation. I sometimes wonder why people apply to work when they don't turn up for work. There are so many people out there wanting work. That message does not seem to get home to people who are fortunate enough to be employed by government. I thought you would, having been employed, you'll know that there are other competitors out there, and it should encourage you to really be doing your work and holding on to it for dear life's sake. But it doesn't produce that kind of result or attitude amongst the human component of the public service here, because people are still coming late to work before they go out to the market during working hours. They leave work before working hours. Sometimes the service try all sorts of ways, including, you know, you sign in when you report in and you sign out when you leave. But of course, people could be doing, they'll be signing out all right, but they might simply be reporting to sign in or sign out, when in fact, in between time, they are so laxed about work performance. And I think, in my view, I thought that our employment opportunity market here is already saturated. But it does not appear to be so when people who are in offices should be working are not working. But I think it's one of discipline, and we will have to continue to work at that. Yeah, the people who are responsible discipline in the various department needs to know that cultural elements must not be allowed to rule the public service.
And just a question about support for reform efforts. Did you experience any resistance to the recent reform efforts, and if so, from which groups?
Right. Resistance from what?
So, for example, was there any resistance to the parliamentary strengthening project or to the strengthening of the accountability institution?
Okay. No. I think everybody appreciate that. Certainly the strengthening of parliament project is highly appreciated by the politicians themselves. And in the recent meeting that has just been concluded, there was a motion moved in parliament to appreciate the work of Warren Cahill how excellent and proficient the staff are now to service both the office and parliamentarians in the area of needs, in the research and writing of whatever they like to do for them. And that is one of the areas I'd like to continue to encourage. We now have trained our officers. They are available for members of parliament to use. They need to know that so that they can make use of them.
Okay, great. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add before we stop?
My only hope is that Solomon Island attitude would improve. Solomon Island public officers' attitude will improve through time. I don't know what will improve that, whether education, a sense of responsibility, love of your work. It certainly, we will have to continue to work at attitude to work ethics. So that people take pride in their work and do the work to the best of their ability. At the moment, there's still very much lackadaisical attitude by our public officers.
All right, well, thanks very much.
Thank you very much indeed.